This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder. He's the author of several books, including Mountains Beyond Mountains and Old Friends. His latest book, My Detachment, is a memoir about his tour of duty in Vietnam. The title refers to the military detachment Tracy Kidder belonged to during the war. It also refers to his emotional detachment, his feeling of being adrift. Tracy Kidder joined the ROTC at Harvard in the mid-60s at a time when Cambridge and other college campuses across the country were beginning to protest the war. And by the time he reported for duty at Fort Benning for training in Army intelligence, Lieutenant Kidder had mixed feelings, to say the least. He had turned against the war. But there he was in the Army, and it wasn't long, and he found himself in Vietnam, just out of college, barely into his 20s, and in command of 8 enlisted men. Their assignment, to home in on enemy radio transmissions. Kidder listened to the war and imagined himself in battle. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Tracy Kidder. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Tracy Kidder's work has been honored with a number of literary prizes, including the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. His new book, the memoir My Detachment, is published by Random House. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Tracy Kidder, good to talk with you again.
Well, thank you.
What led you, to begin with, talk about what led you to join the ROTC at Harvard?
Well, I'm still a little puzzled by that, but basically it was I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And after college, and a friend of mine, a guy I really liked, a person actually I still really like, told me just sort of casually that he joined this ROTC program. It was a one-year ROTC program. You went to basic training the summer after your junior year, and then you did ROTC your senior year, and you went to another basic training, and then you were made an officer. And he said, well, you know, when you leave college, you got to go in the Army anyway, and it's better to be an officer. Now, he was wrong about both things, I mean, probably, but I didn't know that. Then I thought, oh, okay, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
But I do remember, I mean, I was a pretty sheltered, privileged kid, frankly, and when I remember showing up at Fort Knox for basic training, and I think I realized that, personally, I felt as though I'd made a great mistake when these men in these smoky bear hats started speaking very rudely to me, and then they cut off all my hair, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, all through this, I kept coming back to the sense of, you know, what it is like to be a 20-year-old kid.
Yeah, that's really what this book is about. You know, it's about romanticism and other lunacies of youth, you know. I remember a colonel, an Army colonel, once saying, this is a young man's game, meaning war. And I think that's true. I think it's true in part because only very young people would be stupid enough to do it.
You don't know any better.
I'm saying that partly jocularly.
Right.
I don't mean to cast any aspersions on soldiers. I happen to be very fond of soldiers in general. I think they usually get the short end of every stick. I wasn't the kind of soldier who is most put upon, though. I mean, you know, I think there is one reason I decided to finally write this thing, publish it, was that I got a little tired of the myths about Vietnam. One of them that bothered me the most was the notion that somehow or other everybody who went there suffered a dramatically bad time. You know, The problem with that is that some percentage, but a minority, I think, did suffer a dramatically bad time. That is, those people who were in combat one way or another. And after the war, a few years after the fall of Saigon, when I was a writer for the Atlantic Monthly, I went out all around the country and wrote about Vietnam combat veterans. And indeed, they had been really shafted. I mean, you know, horrifying stories of paralyzed veterans being put in, you know, rat-infested wards in VA hospitals in places like the Bronx. You know, those distinctions between the people who were in combat and those who weren't, like me, who weren't, were terribly important when you were there. And I think that, you know, they, I don't know, maybe I'm just, this is something inchoate, but it bothers me to see this sort of romantic notion about that, that we were all somehow tragic heroes, perpetuated.
Yeah. Well, there are vets that I have talked to who say, look, I wasn't in combat. I was an era vet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sat on a ship off the shore, that
well,
kind of thing.
And most of the soldiers who were actually on land there weren't in what I think most people would call combat. It was a different kind of war for those of us who weren't in combat. I don't mean to say that there weren't some dangers, but I still think I would have been in more danger back home a late adolescent with a driver's license, you know.
Yeah. When you were about to be shipped out, at that point, how did you imagine what was ahead of you?
Oh, I didn't imagine it all accurately. I'd been to lots and lots of training camps, but I really hadn't been prepared for. I'd been prepared to some degree for my technical job, but in no other way was I really prepared. I kind of imagined that everywhere we'd land in Vietnam, we'd be under fire. Instead, we weren't. We'd be sort of collected in some place and then wait. It's always the way in the military. So I didn't know what to expect, really. I expected something dramatic and kind of horrible. And instead, for the most part, I got something kind of boring and sort of vulgar.
And
some of it was very funny. I mean, at least in retrospect, to me.
Some very absurd things.
Yes, yes, indeed. But I think, you know, that's one of the characteristics of military service. I think universally, it's, you know, there's just such huge numbers of people you're moving around. I've recently been rereading Tolstoy's great, you know, War and Peace, and some of it seems, very familiar to me. I think that Vietnam has not encouraged. I mean, has inspired an awful lot of books, but none that you could really call comic. I think that, you know, and maybe that's because even now, after, you know, 30 years or so after the fall of Saigon, American views are unresolved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for some, Vietnam stands as this national disgrace. The fact that we fought the war at all, and for others. The ideas like that and the war itself remain a source of great resentment. So I think if there's an emotional consensus about the war, it's that some form of sadness is the only mood appropriate to its memory. But, you know, the truth is, I think that anyone who's been in military service knows that there's, you know, that people in war and in the service are sometimes hilarious, sometimes preposterous. Alas, was both.
Yeah. You must be a fan of Catch-22.
I am. It's really my favorite book from World War II, and a very funny book, but unsparing too in the tragedy and vulgarity of war.
Yeah. Now, as a young man in college, you wanted to be a writer when you were there at Harvard.
Yes.
And you mentioned War and Peace, now reading that now.
Well, I'm rereading it.
Rereading it, right.
Yeah.
What, you know, what kind of books had you read at that point in your life about war? Had you read The Naked and the Dead? Had you read Catch-22?
I had read, I don't remember if I'd read Catch-22. It wouldn't have meant that much to me. I hadn't read the great anti-war novels. I had read Hemingway, mostly, on war. And it's not to say I like Hemingway. I mean, he's kind of been denigrated in recent years, but I think he was a wonderful writer. But I must say, he introduced me to the idea of the writer as himself a hero, you know, and I I'd really taken it to heart, the whole idea of the, you know, love and decency sort of ruined by war. It's somehow or other, you know, so much stuff that, and this is also very true of movies, I think, so much stuff that is anti-war tends to make war seem romantic, and I'm not quite sure why that is. But, and in any case, it was mostly Hemingway, I think. And who else had I read on war? But it's, I guess, you know, Joseph Conrad, although that's not really quite the same thing. But I don't think, but I hadn't read the what I consider the great realistic anti-war novels, All Quiet on the Western Front, or Goodbye to All That, really one of the, those great books from World War One, just Hemingway's notions about it.
Yeah. So when did you really begin to think about the romantic notion of the hero, of the warrior?
Well, an awful lot for me. I don't know if this is true for other young men, you know, college-age young men, had to do with women, girls. And, you know, almost anything that seemed... Maybe I misunderstood your question, but I mean, the whole reason I wanted to become a writer in the first place was that writing stories seemed like a way of meeting and impressing girls. And I think that I somehow transmogrified the whole experience of going to war into something that would be impressive to you know, young women back home or something like that. I don't pretend to fully understand all these things. I'm sorry. I'm kind of floundering here.
Well, maybe you would talk.
I think, you know, you get a dignity. Joining up gives you think anyway a dignity and an importance and an identity too. Although a lot of young people don't really know what they're. You know, what they're getting into, and they don't know what to do anyway. I think for girls, for young women, the equivalent used to be getting married and having babies. And I perhaps it's true that female romantic ideas feed the myth of the warrior. You know, the idea of a man being willing to risk life and limb for a grand cause. But all that's just sort of theory. I just remember... not particularly wanting to go. I mean, I think my feeling, which, you know, changed over time, but just personally, I when I came back from Vietnam, I wanted to be a person who had been in combat, but I knew that I never wanted to actually be in combat.
Yeah. Well, all these things combined, I suspect you would say they contributed to the things that you wrote home.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I invented a whole story about what I was doing over there. I mean, it was sort of vague, but I wanted people to feel that I was somehow in danger. I even invented a couple of Vietnamese boys to befriend. I actually wrote a children's story for these two Vietnamese boys. So, you know, I think the way I wrote it in my book was to say that I was trying to depict myself as this rugged guy with smudges on his cheeks from sleeping in a foxhole, you know, one hand holding an M16, the other resting protectively on the shoulders of a couple of Vietnamese boys. I even gave them names. And I even wrote this children's story for them and sent the story to my girlfriend thinking this would impress her. You know, I was a warrior who'd found his true gentleness in war or something. I mean, it was wonderful. When I think back about it, I just think how crazy I was. Here's a story written, a whole big, long children's story written for two Vietnamese kids who didn't exist, and even if they had, wouldn't have been able to read it.
Well, it puts one in mind of you know, movies where we see like a Cary Grant or a John Wayne or, you know, rescuing the, with you know, one hand on the rudder and another hand on the gun and sheltering the children behind, you know.
the nicest thing anybody said to me about this little memoir of mine came from a guy in jail who'd written to me asking if, I guess he'd read a review or something. He'd been a Vietnam veteran. And he wrote me back after he'd read. He said, well, at least you're one Vietnam veteran who doesn't pretend to be both the Dalai Lama.
Both the Dalai Lama and...
And John Wayne.
Yeah.
I apologize for that. I think that's my...
The phone.
Waiting.
Yeah, the phone, I think.
Yeah.
We had a little blip there. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Tracy Kidder is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is My Detachment. It is a memoir about his duty in Vietnam, his tour of duty in the Army in Vietnam. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You know, your memoir is about a time and about a war that continues to stir emotions. And as we've touched on so far, it's also funny and touching. It's also, you know, as a memoir is, it's very personal. Was it difficult to write this book?
Yeah, actually it was for me. Couple of reasons. I mean, one was that around the time when I started to write it 20 years ago, the memoir craze had hit. You know, just about everyone seemed to be writing a memoir, including an awful lot of people who didn't seem to have done anything else in their lives except write the memoir. And I didn't want to be part of the fad, and that's part of why I put it aside. But also, I found it very difficult to write about these memories that, some of which still make me wince, I should admit. That I found rather painful to, and that would come to me, you know, unsummoned. The way I started to write it was with a self-flagellating tone, that as if to assert that there was an enormous distance between me and this young man, this young lieutenant, as if to assert maybe that we'd never actually been related at all. And I... it just didn't work. It was phony, and I put it aside and went on to other things. When I came back to it in between other books, and my old friend and longtime sort of editor, a guy named Richard Todd, persuaded me. Really, he always liked this. I've always thought it was a little bit because he gave him so much material to tease me about, but he persuaded me that it could be an interesting and entertaining book, and so I decided to finish. And I find, you know, frankly, that memories that are painful, once they're out in the open where they can't ambush you anymore, are a lot easier to deal with. So it really doesn't bother me anymore, most of this stuff. When I was working on it, I said to this friend of mine, Dick Todd, that I wasn't sure I wanted my children to read this, and he said, "Oh, your kids will be fine." Said it's your wife I'd worry about. But she seems to, she just sort of shook her head at me when she read it. You know, I don't know. Yeah, if there was a book that I had in mind when I was writing it, I'm not sure it was fully there. But have you ever read the long story, maybe you call it a novella, by Joseph Conrad called Youth?
No.
It's a lovely story, and this shares a little something with it. I mean, you know, I'm perfectly prepared to now look at myself at 23 or whatever it was, and not feel too upset about it anymore. And also, I think, you know, I don't want to give away the end of my story, but I do think that at the end, which it's a true story, what I tell you at the end, but it does acknowledge that perhaps the distance between me and that kid isn't so great even now.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to ask you to tell that story, but I guess we'll leave it.
Oh, I will if you want.
Yeah. When you meet up with your one of the men that you served with who was under your command, Pancho.
Yeah, a guy I came to be tremendously fond of, really interesting, restless character. When I first took command of my detachment, eight men, I really didn't have a clue as to how to handle troops, you know, and no one had ever given me any instruction in that, and I really bumbled around a lot. At a certain point, he he came to see me in my hooch and basically told me that he and the other men could shoot me anytime they wanted to. I think those were his exact words. And I took that very much to heart, frankly. I don't think I ever gave him a direct order after that, but we would discuss things. He was perfectly reasonable. He just didn't want to be harassed. Anyway, I'd heard from him. Long after the war, I heard from him periodically. And then he actually came to visit me. That must be almost 20 years ago. And we had long talk. And I conversed, long conversation, which, thank God, I tape recorded. And with his knowledge, I should add. And then we went to lunch. Shall I tell that story?
Yeah, please.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, it would be great.
I'll read it.
It would be great. He's a wonderful character. He's an outrageous character. He's, doesn't he tell you at some point, you know, that's how you are free. You just get out there and
he said,
be yourself. And
I wanted to ask him, I'll read from here. You know, I'd asked him a question I wasn't sure I really wanted answered about a terrible incident where I behaved, I thought, really ignobly. And he made me feel better about it. He just laughed, his shaky laugh this time, and said, I had a lot of freedom simply because I made it that way. We went on talking, and at one point he said, I never had any great plans to being anybody, but when I'm involved in something, I'm always scheming because I don't like things to be the normal everyday drudgery. As he continued, saying that he wanted to travel more, that it was in his blood, it occurred to me that he had just stated the essential difference between us back when we'd been soldiers. He had wanted to have an interesting life. I had wanted to be interesting. We lingered over coffee. Finally, it seemed as though there was nothing more to say. We got up to leave. Sliding out of the booth, I knocked the cushion off the bench. It fell beneath the table. I got down on one knee, stuck my hand under the table, and was groping for the cushion when I heard Pancho say, musingly to himself, same old lieutenant.
It's a great story.
Thanks. Yeah. That was his nickname, and he'd never used before or since.
Right. But it was okay for you to call him that.
Well, that's what he said.
That's what he said. Yeah.
I don't mind if you call me that.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. We have a caller waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Is that... Am I on?
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't catch the name of the book in the beginning, and it sounds interesting.
My Detachment.
My Detachment. Oh, okay. That sounds good. I'm enjoying the show, and I would like to ask the guest to maybe mention, which probably is in the book, what they actually did from day to day on that radio, listening to those radios, and then I'll just hang on.
Oh, well, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong communicated via encrypted Morse code. And at the higher headquarters than mine, all those encrypted messages were intercepted and recorded. But if any of the messages were actually read, decoded, decrypted, I never would have known that. That would have been a secret, too secret for me to know. But we had these experts in, who are very good at their job, by the way, at breaking down communications networks, so they could, at any given time, they had the whole network laid out, so they could say that this was the radio operator of a certain North Vietnamese unit, for instance. And in addition, through coordination with other units, we were able to get locations on those radios. On those transmitters, in any case, that was the main stuff that I would then, that information would be relayed to me, and I would take it to the commander of the infantry brigade.
How serious were you about this job?
About doing that?
Yeah.
Well, I was quite serious. I mean, it was my job, and it could be kind of fascinating. I had this great huge map, and I'd always loved maps, and on the map I had these. And we had all these symbols of where all these various enemy units were situated. And it was fascinating from day to day. I mean, most of life, you know, in a base camp is pretty boring. But that was one of the more interesting parts of it. And we could see, I used to, just sort of sitting around shooting the breeze with one guy. And this almost got us in trouble once. We'd try to imagine, you know, patterns and so on and so forth. And at one point, I was actually tempted to share my theories with the brigade commander, but yeah. Fortunately, I didn't get to do that. Completely cockamamie theory about what was going on.
Yeah. And what was life like at the end of the workday?
We had a TV, and there was something called the Armed Forces Vietnam Network, and my men and I would watch TV. Mostly, what I remember watching most often was a show called Combat,
yeah.
Which is about World War II infantry platoon, I think. And we would drink. I had a wonderful sergeant, a buck sergeant, a man with just one of those people who just had natural authority. Young guy, you know, about my age, of a southerner. He didn't believe in drugs and narcotics anyway. I mean, and the men just obeyed him. He was tremendous. He was enviable to me in that way. But so far as I know, my men didn't use narcotics at all. You know, not even marijuana, and they were everywhere around us in Vietnam. But we did. But my sergeant did believe in beer, and we drank a lot of beer.
Yeah, it's amazing to think at that time you could see on television. I don't know if you could see it in Vietnam, but in the States you could watch combat, and then you could
watch real combat.
Yeah.
No,
and
we didn't.
You could also watch Hogan's Heroes. It was, you know.
Yeah. We didn't get, you know, the only, every so often I'd get a copy of something like Time magazine. And I do remember vividly reading all about what our secret crypto mission in Time magazine. Quite accurate description of it. But for the most part, all we had was the Army publication Stars and Stripes. And you know, there were a lot of things happening back in the States during that year that I never heard about until I got home.
What was it like coming home?
It was strange. A year at that point when you're in your 20s is still a fairly large percentage of your life.
Yeah.
So it felt strange. I remember traveling to the civilian airport in San Francisco and just not being noticed, really, and being pleased, happy about that, and not so happy about that. For me, I just wanted to clear out of this and put it behind me and never think about it again and get out of military service. I know others felt differently, and I think particularly if you'd had a very bad time there, if you'd been in combat, it did seem like a tremendous letdown. I realize I've been criticized since this book was published for insinuating that this story that we heard a lot, many times, that soldiers coming home running into anti-war demonstrations and getting spat on, that I say in my book that I don't think this happened very often. I know that it did happen sometimes, but I just feel like when you hear a story that many times and it's so similar each time, that what you're probably hearing is a story that's been told and is beginning to pass into the category of legend or, you know, or myth, but it is an absolutely accurate, psychologically, morally, some way or other, it's an absolutely apt story about the way an awful lot of soldiers felt coming home from Vietnam and had every right to feel. I think I talked about it earlier about just how horribly mistreated Vietnam combat veterans were, particularly combat veterans. But for me, it was it was just a great relief and a kind of great release. I wasn't discharged from the Army. I still had a little more time to serve, but it did feel like that part of my life was over, and I was glad it was over. I still didn't know what I was going to do next.
Yeah, yeah. So you.
Which is that awful feeling, when you're in your 20s, it's too much for me.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about that book that you sat down and wrote once you were out and finished in 1970. But before we do that, I want to go back to this idea of the veterans who came back during the Vietnam era. They came home mostly alone, and no one said thanks. And the veterans, I think, by and large, kept their heads down.
I think they did. There was when I did all that research about combat veterans, I was told by a VA psychiatrist, an administrator, that at the end of that war, for a little while, they thought that the Vietnam had had a smaller percentage of psychological casualties than other wars before, but it turned out that it was just about the same as every other war. The reason that it seemed different at first was that so many veterans were afraid that if they confessed to having psychological problems, they might not be allowed out. And, you know, they were extremely distrustful. The Veterans Administration was not nice to Vietnam veterans, nor were, I think, the veterans organizations by and large. They were, at that time, still pretty much dominated by World War II veterans, and they had a kind of low opinion of Vietnam veterans. We'd lost, after all, or, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was being tarred, as somebody once put it, with the brush of My Lai, you know. The truth is that it was a war that was fought by America's working class, by and large. You know, kids like me really didn't have to go for the greatest part of the war. It was tremendously unfair, that draft. I mean, I think the volunteer army kind of reproduces that, by the way, but that same unfairness. But disproportionate numbers of African Americans and Hispanics were in the service, and if you looked at you know, the percentages of people who were assigned to the combat arms, it was even more glaring. That is, you know, social class, economic status, educational status had everything that it correlated pretty nicely with how much, the poorer and the less educated you were, the more likely you were to be put in the most dangerous kind of, given the most dangerous kind of service. So, you know, from the start to the end, it was pretty bad. And the benefits, you know, I think one effect of this whole sort of myth about Vietnam, that, and actually everybody who served during the Vietnam era, that everyone should be treated, all these veterans should be treated equally, I think that was benighted. You can see why it would serve the purposes of politicians, but it was benighted because some people needed help a lot more than others, and they weren't getting it. Didn't get it.
I can get
quite worked up over this.
Yeah. No, I remember in the early 80s doing a documentary with my husband, and we called it Still Coming Home.
Yeah.
Because the guys weren't getting what they needed.
You know, and I think things are better now, but I worry that, you know, once the Iraq veterans, you know, are not young and... I mean, I just question this country's commitment to taking care of its soldiers, and, you know, both while they're over there and when they're home, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we have good reason to worry about that, given, you know, what we know now about the protective vests in Iraq and the armor of the Humvees and so on. I mean, it sounds pretty similar to me.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I just want to thank you for saying what you did about I think it's a myth also about soldiers being sped upon and so forth by these dirty hippie protesters, because the fact is the people who were against the war, myself included, and I was of that age, I was a conscientious objector. I served for 2 years alternative service. But those were my friends, people I knew who went over there for one reason or another. And so, like you say, when you hear that story, it's the same thing. And I try to explain this to people. I said, you know, those were my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just what you're talking about, the treatment by the government of our veterans, I think you see the same thing now.
Yeah.
You know, they're used by political leaders, and then when they do come back and the bill is due to take care of them, they get forgotten.
Yeah. You know, I just to clarify one thing, I don't say that it didn't happen.
No, I know.
And,
I know.
And,
I'm sure.
I know it
did.
Actually has some photographs.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it was. It's just a.
You just if you hear it so much, they make it sound like it was just a widespread, and that all the people who were protesting against the war, and that was my point. You know, you can be against the policy.
Sorry, treat
those people who decided to serve. Because and I know people, you know, and they went, they didn't want to go, but their family, you know, said, this is your duty, this is your, you know, my family said, you know, this is your 18, this is your decision.
Right.
My brother was a Marine,
right.
And, you know, he said, you know, you're either in this 100% or don't do it.
Right.
And he believed in what we were doing. So,
yeah.
I really appreciate all the stuff you're saying there.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. One of the things you say late in the book about the working class who had been doing the work, the grunt work of the war, in the end, then we come back to this point where veterans are coming home and are alone, as I mentioned before, and keeping their heads down. There was this really great tension between, I think, even, you know, between those who had served and those who had not. And one of the things, though, that you say late in the book is, you know, no one blames the veterans anymore. We've stopped doing that.
Yeah.
Is that the big change, do you think?
I think that's true. The big change, I think the big change, frankly, is that we've all gotten older and, you know, there are whole generations now who aren't even aware, you know, don't even know what it was. But I still think that if you dig just a little, scratch scratch the surface, those same strong feelings will erupt, you know. I mean, I had, and I wrote about this, you know, I felt my opposition to the war when I was over there as a soldier, though I think it grew while I was there, you know, and it was based on something. The opposition I felt when I went there was more sort of social than anything else. I felt like, gee, all my friends are against this war. What's the matter with me? You know, I mean, I was really malleable. And you know, but that's still true. I still have a lot of friends who protested the war. And I sometimes, even now, we can sometimes get into lively little arguments about it. I mean, basically, I'll say something unfair, and they'll say something unfair. I'll generally say, that's nice, you let all the poor people in this country fight that war for you, you know. But I just think it's a lot more rational and sane now, you know. It is a weird, one of the other things, though, that's happened is that it's, I talk about that mood of sadness. It's something more than that as well that that war seems to invoke. One book I wrote a few years ago was largely about a policeman in a fairly small city, very small city. And I can't tell you how many times he arrested people who, you know, had lots of problems, usually drugs and stuff, and who claimed that their troubles had begun when they during service in Vietnam. I mean, this must have happened four or five times or six times when I was with him. And these were people who hadn't even been out of diapers by the time the Saigon fell, you know. So it had become I don't really have a word for it. But I do think that that's an important change, because I don't think that, you know, the anti-war movement was huge, and so there was an enormous variety there. But I do think people did blame soldiers at a certain point, and you know, accuse us of being baby killers. And I do know that, you know, on the college of Harvard, at the campus of Harvard, you could be quite heavily harassed in your ROTC uniform, you know. I think that's one thing that's fundamentally better today about that. Although I don't like the sentimentality that this country has towards war, but blaming soldiers for wars is just idiotic. You know, soldiers don't start wars, and indeed, you know, it's usually soldiers who can tell you why you shouldn't fight them if you can possibly avoid it.
Have you heard from soldiers who have served since Vietnam or are serving now who've read the book?
No, I haven't heard very much from... I think this book sort of traveled under the radar. Not quite sure why. But in any case, I haven't. Just this one... The only letter I got was from this one fellow in prison. Was quite interesting. He'd had a lot of trouble when he got back from Vietnam, and I guess he was in combat. But no, I haven't heard too much. I think in part the fact that this is not, you know, your standard war book. It's not about it's not shoot 'em up and all that sort of stuff. I like to think it's pretty lively and even sort of tense in moments, but it's not what. I think the story I'm telling isn't one that feeds the, you know, our preconceived notions about the thing. So that's my take on it.
Let's talk with another listener. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Yes, thank you. I certainly agree that it's reprehensible that wars are often fought by the poor people, and that certainly... That was the case largely in Vietnam and today in Iraq. I would disagree with your statement that, you know, they're fighting the wars for us, or for me. I don't believe they're being fought for me. I think they're being fought for Halliburton and Dow Chemical and Bechtel and those, you know, people who own those corporations.
You completely misunderstood me. I talked about how I was one arguing with... unfairly with my friends, who were in the anti-war movement. I would say you let them fight it for you, but I don't for a moment believe that.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, because I think, you know, that's just another way that the soldiers get abused, is that it's this lie that we keep perpetrating that. You know, we go to war for democracy, and that's not what these wars are being fought for.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, as it happens. Yeah, they never are, though. You know, I still don't understand why the Vietnam War was fought. I really don't. I've read an awful lot about it. Doesn't make much sense to me.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Tracy Kidder, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of My Detachment, which is a memoir about his tour of duty in Vietnam, a book published by Random House. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, tell us now about that book that you sat down to write, Ivory Fields.
Ivory Fields. Well, it's a novel all about experiences I didn't have in Vietnam. And I didn't keep a journal when I was there. I was much too young and callow to do that. But I think a psychiatrist might consider that novel sort of a journal. It was, in it, I created an infantry platoon and a lieutenant who was... Whom I tried to make very different from me, but I mean, there was a sort of psychological trickiness to all of that, I think. Anyway, it was, you know, very, very dramatic, and completely overblown, you know.
Yeah. And we can see that. We can see that in this book.
Yes, I tried not to. But I thought it was kind of nice to have that running. And I wrote Lieutenant, I called him Dempsey was his name, like Lieutenant Dempsey's experiences in the war, also very different, of course, analogous to mine, perhaps, but much more dramatic. The big shadows on the wall looming over me. For one thing, he gets shot to death. And I went on, a reader might well think that the traits Dempsey and I had in common were fiction, and at the same time imagine that some of Dempsey's fictional experiences resembled mine. I imagined the book's reception. Yeah. Imagine the book's reception. I could see myself denying that I had suffered as he does. The more I demurred, the more the reader would think of me. He must have seen some stuff over there.
Yeah.
Of course, it was never published, thank God.
Yeah. Well, it also hints back to the great line in this book where you're, ouch, you're talking with Marianne, and you realize the hint of a terrible war story was the best war story of all.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's interesting now we're seeing this these controversies over memoir and first novels, you know.
Yes.
What I'm you know the, and
yes, I know about that.
Somebody made the point the other day on the media, the NPR program, that it used to be that you would write a first novel and it would be largely autobiographical.
Uh-huh.
But now you're writing a memoir that's largely fictional.
Yeah.
You know, that's where you start.
Right.
It's,
well, can I speak about that a little?
Yeah, please.
Well, to me, you know, memoir is not what I consider nonfiction. I mean, when I write what I call nonfiction, I try to make sure that everything is accurate. Of course, I make mistakes, but I certainly don't make them on purpose. I think of memoir as occupying a place somewhere between fiction and nonfiction, and that only because it's named for memory, which is the most plastic of all the human faculties. You know, one of the less reliable human faculties. If you're telling a story like the one I told, I tried to make this book absolutely accurate to my memories. I can't swear because I don't mm-hmm. have, you know. I mean, I could have gone back and tried to find as many people as I could who shared this experience with me, but I know that their memories would be just as questionable as mine, and. In the end, I think that's okay. I think that to deliberately fabricate stuff is probably too bad. And then call it memoir. I think that's too bad. But I can't claim to have achieved strict accuracy here. And I somehow feel that the form allows that.
Yeah.
There are some people now. I've been reading a few things out there who are deploring this, the inaccuracies in memoirs. Who've written ones themselves, which contain enormous long sections of dialogue, which they probably didn't tape record or get down in their notes. And I think some of this is a little overblown. On the other hand, I do. I think there are just too many memoirs, and I like this little book, and I think that if anybody reads anything I've written 50 years from now, this will be one of the things they might read. But I think I don't want to write any more memoirs, and I find it. I think that the whole trend toward writing memoirs isn't so great, particularly for young writers. They ought to be getting out into the world and finding out about other people, and I think they ought to. Learn during that experience that there are other subjects in the world besides dysfunctional families. That's pretty much my take on memoir.
Well, one of the nice things I think you do in My Detachment in terms of signaling us, the reader, is that you say, the first time I wrote this down, it was 4 years after it happened. And I think that's in a story about a fellow by the name of Dennis Morisot.
Yeah.
And so you signal to us, kids, it's been a long time. I was, 22, 23 years old. And so I didn't write this down for a long time. But here's what I remember.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the best you can do. And if you think, not everything you remember is worth putting in a book, but I think it's mm-hmm. a little crazy to demand, strict factual accuracy from memoir. On the other hand, the one that's being debated about, I haven't read, so I really shouldn't, I don't have too much to say about it, but if it does seem to me that the kind of, there are certain kinds of things that you are likely to remember accurately. And one would be, just how long you spent in jail.
Right.
I know exactly how many days I spent in Vietnam, and as it happens, I can prove it. There are documents for things like that.
Yeah.
I spent 362 days there. I had what we called a three-day drop. Seemed like an eternity. Does that make sense?
Yes. When you sat down to write this particular book, how did you sort through the memories, and how did you decide, well, this one's important, this one, I don't know, you know, because you've got more than 362 days. You've got what came before and what came after.
Well, I think those kinds of decisions are pretty similar whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction or memoir. You don't ever put down everything that, I mean, if you're writing nonfiction, you don't write down, you don't put in your book everything that you found out. I mean, mm-hmm. some people do, but I never have. And then becomes the question of emphasis and what gets accent and what doesn't. My friend Dick Todd, who's helped me so much over the years, once said the whole art of this is making some things big and other things little. And so I think it's only working through that material itself that you can start to discover what ought to be big and what ought to be little. So I can't answer the question mm-hmm. in any mm-hmm. less vague way than that. For me, there was the additional problem, of course, of remembering stuff. And remembering one thing sometimes leads you to remember another and another and another. And that was part of what was interesting and challenging about this for me, was making my memory get to work on stuff that had been really put away for quite a while.
Yeah. It's also going to be really helpful to take it out and look at it, make sense of it in a disciplined fashion.
Uh-huh. What did for me, I mean, some of those memories really troubled me. That novel that I wrote, that preposterous novel, was quite useful once it resurfaced. I had thought that I had burned up all the copies of it. I tell that story in the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And then a friend who was cleaning out his file sent me a copy. And I found all sorts of analogs there, and I could remember writing some parts of that book and remember what I was thinking of more or less, when I wrote it, so that would lead me back to something that happened while I was in the service.
Mm.
It's a way of going back. There are problems with one of the other problems that I ran into years ago when I was writing about an article for the Atlantic Monthly about the House Committee's investigation of the JFK assassination. I remember the chief counsel saying to me that one of the problems is that all the witnesses no longer remember what they actually saw or heard, or they remember what they've said about it over mm-hmm. the years. And one tells war stories. I'd told some of the stories that are in this book before, and you start to remember.